We live in a very confusing time for the state of space exploration. In theory, NASA is going to be sending humans to the moon in the next couple of years. We're seeing the construction, but the concerns about the space launch system. We're going to see more and more tests of Starship, and yet Starship is one of the parts of the Artemis mission. Is it going to hold up the mission? What's going on with Blue Origin? What about the Chinese? What's the state of the International Space Station? Like I said, there's a lot going on, and so I was really fortunate to be able to bring on one of the, if not the best space journalist in the industry, and that is Eric Berger from Ars Technica. Eric writes so much and has deep inside knowledge and connections to everybody at all of the space agencies and rocket companies, and does just excellent reporting. And he recently came out with a new book called Reentry, which is all about SpaceX's design and development of reusability with the Falcon 9 rocket. I read his book, it was terrific, and now I had a chance to ask Eric some questions about the book, but mostly about the state of space exploration in this very strange and turbulent times. All right, enjoy the interview with Eric Berger. Eric, it's good to see you again.
Hey, it's great to be back, Fraser. Thanks so much.
So before we get into the conversation, because it is a very dynamic unfolding situation that's going on across all of both human and robotic spaceflight, I want to just tell you how much I loved your book, which is why you're here.
That's very generous. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So for those of you who are watching, you know, your new book, Reentry, is really all about SpaceX's plan approach to accomplish powered return reusable spacecraft moving towards Starship. It's a phenomenal book, 400 pages. I don't know how big the final version is. And the level of detail, I don't know how you did it. So,
well, I just talked to all of the really smart engineers and technicians who over the last 15 years took the Falcon 9 rocket and through its teething pains early on, and then really understanding how they managed to, you know, land the rocket, refly it, and then fly it frequently. And then also, oh, by the way, they also had to build the cargo version and then the crew version of the Dragon spacecraft. So it just basically tells the story of the development of Falcon 9 and Dragon up through about 2020 when, you know, when they had the first successful crew mission.
And what's really interesting for me, like you, having reported on all of this stuff, but I reported on it one level removed with the, you know, seeing the announcements from NASA and seeing the press releases and in some cases talking to people, but not that level of, and it was amazing to see it from the other side, seeing the internal struggles, seeing the stories, how much they had to sort of lower costs to be able to accomplish some of the tasks that they did. The closest I got was I was at NASA after they had the explosion on the pad, and we sort of took a tour right past the rocket, and I saw the burned out gantry, and it was, but still, like, just to be able to hear the stories was absolutely incredible. So thank you for writing this book, and yet it's already out of date. So,
well, the idea really was two things. First of all, to take readers behind the scenes. So as you say, you know, we all sort of watch this unfold from the outside, from the perspective of NASA, or from what we were here from SpaceX, or from Elon Musk, or from Glenn Shotwell, and really to kind of go behind the scenes and talk to the people who are making it happen and kind of put you beside them in the factory, in the control room, wherever they were sort of making all of the hard work, you know, to accomplish this. And so it was to bring their stories forward, to tell the story of the rise of SpaceX and the Falcon 9. And really, the other idea was to set the stage for the Starship era, right? You look at all of the lessons that SpaceX learned with reusing rockets with the Falcon 9, and then all of the lessons they learned from human spaceflight with Dragon. And you take all those, like for example, with Dragon's, you know, originally it was supposed to be propulsive landing, right? It was supposed to land under the power of its Super Draco thrusters. And that spacecraft just got so complex that with that propellant management system that they had to scuttle propulsive landing. And so they took all of that and pushed it forward into Starship. But they had all these lessons learned about complexity, and they just had to simplify things for Starship. And so, yeah, it was to kind of bring readers up to the modern era and say, okay, here's how the company got to this point that they're able to do these pretty crazy things with Starship.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that part was quite interesting that I think the managers on the team, you say, kind of regretted pushing the team so hard to get that reusability into Dragon. And then it ended up not needing the propulsive landing. Although I guess, you know, it's theoretically available again in an emergency situation. So who knows, but.
Yeah. It was not the managers. It was Elon Musk who pushed the team hard. And then in a moment of regret in the fall of 2019 confided to me that, well, yeah, maybe I did push them a little too hard. And believe me, they felt pushed very hard.
Yeah. Well, and I think the story that you see throughout the book, and I think this is a larger conversation, is that all of these incredible people are pushed to their limit and in many cases to the end of their limit. And then they resign. And that seems to be the story over and over again, is that people did their best work, and yet it was too much for them every time.
Yeah, that's really a key theme that I tried to get at, is you tell the story of these people through kind of their rise at SpaceX, these amazing things they did, and then almost all of them at the end were burnt out or had enough. And so it was really to kind of to bring forward also what it was like to be inside the fire of working at SpaceX. I mean, it's an incredibly unique opportunity. You're literally working on the cutting edge of science and fiction. You're bringing things into the world that did not exist and that really do advance humanity's, you know, entry into the solar system and beyond. I mean, SpaceX is absolutely pushing the envelope on this. It's no longer NASA. It's SpaceX that's kind of at the frontier of this stuff. But at the same time, you know, you're working incredibly hard. The expectation is that you'll work 60 or 80 hours a week kind of at a minimum, and then it goes up from there when there are crunch time with major projects. And it, you know, it can be a demanding work environment, especially if you're a senior manager, a director, or a vice president, and you have an interface with Elon. It can be pretty brutal at times.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Elon has become quite a polarizing figure. And I think for a lot of people, they don't want to hear anything that is associated with him. And yet I think, you know, you read this book and you get the nuance, you get the shades of gray, the, on the one hand, the bold risk-takingness, and on the other hand, the sort of meat grinder of what it's like to work with him. And I think, you know, in the end, you have some words, you have some recommendations, you have some concerns about the direction that things are taking. So I think no matter where you fall, if you're like super into space flight and you think this is the best, I think you're going to get a ton out of the book. And if you're concerned about this, I think you'll also get a lot of, because it's 12,000 engineers who are working their hardest to advance space flight beyond anything we could even have imagined 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I really struggled with that. You know, I was in the process of really getting into reporting for the book back around the time that Elon bought Twitter, and went through that whole process, which was, you know, it was a challenging time, right? He was attacking journalists. I'm a journalist. He was attacking, you know, lots of different people, and increasingly being, you know, much more conservative, and that's fine, as politics are his politics, but he's clearly going down some conspiracy whole theories. I really struggled with sort of, how do you write a book about SpaceX, which is, you know, this ultra successful company, and at the same time contextualize it or help people understand how this can be happening with SpaceX when the kind of opposite's happening with Twitter, right? They're losing advertisers hand over fist. They're losing users, and financially they're really struggling. And I sort of got through that ultimately by, you know, focusing more on the engineers themselves who did the work. I mean, Elon is still a very important part of the book. I mean, SpaceX is Elon. Elon is SpaceX. They're really inseparable. And, you know, you see people try to say, well, he just bought SpaceX, or it was all the engineers that did the work. And like, look, you know, the guy has serious flaws, but he built SpaceX from day one with his vision. He hired these people. He gave them the goals. And then he has kept pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing for more than two decades. I mean, you cannot separate the success of SpaceX from Elon Musk. And so that was that. I really struggled with sort of framing all of that. But yeah, the idea was to give readers a nuanced sense of what it was really like to work at SpaceX and why they were so successful.
Yeah. And so I think no matter where you, how you feel about this situation as it continues to unfold, you're going to get a ton out of the book. So again, congratulations. I thought it was so good. So let's shift gears then and talk about all of the stuff that we've all been madly reporting on as things are really unfolding rapidly. And so, you know, like I said, I've got this laundry list. We'll try to get through as many of them as we can. And so I think the elephant in the room is the state of Artemis and the continued funding of the Space Launch System, even if it wasn't Trump and Musk leading the government moving into 2025. What is your understanding of where things stand right now?
So it's all in flux. I do think there was going to be a major rethink of Artemis regardless of who won the election. Like if Kamala had won the election, I think there would have been a decent chance that you would have seen a situation where they looked pretty hard at SLS and maybe canceled the upgrade. So Block 1B upgrade and then potentially Gateway as well to more refocus on the lunar surface. I think that would have been under active consideration, at least. I think with Trump winning and Elon being involved in space policy, at least in an advisory capacity, although he's not up there writing space policy, right? He's not writing in the name of the next NASA administrator. He is certainly in Trump's ear. However, we just found out that Trump is actually going to be at the sixth Starship launch on Tuesday. So my sense is that much more drastic changes are on the table. A couple of people I talk to who I have a pretty good sense of things tell me there's a good chance that the SLS rocket is just canceled. That the government, you know, looks at this and says, why are we paying $4 billion a launch for basically to get four people to lunar orbit when there are ways to do this far cheaper? You know, you could do it probably not with Starship, but you could certainly do it with Falcon Heavy and a Vulcan rocket, right, to get Orion out to the moon. So I think that's under active consideration, and it's not going to happen soon. It will be months, not weeks, before that decision ultimately made. But you know, let's face it, these programs, the Orion and SLS, have been running for 15 and 20 years almost respectively, and we haven't even launched crew yet. And they're costing an exorbitant amount of money. They are the opposite of efficient. And you know, Boeing and Lockheed and NASA just have not executed. You know, these systems were originally supposed to launch in 2015, then 2017, then 2019, ultimately finally launched in 2022. And here we are 3 years later, or 2 years later, and we haven't seen a second launch yet. You know, the Starship vehicle is going to have launched, what, a dozen times or more between SLS launches. So it's just, if you're looking at government efficiency in the space program, that's kind of where you start.
But I always describe it as this really difficult limbo that the whole situation is stuck in. Like on the one hand, you've got this unsustainable rocket development, $4 billion per launch, completely, you know, no part of it is reusable, with large infrastructure that's going to be able to support it, that's going to move you towards that partially reusable architecture that gets you down to the surface of the moon. And yet your other option is to go, okay, let's just scrap all that and let's live in FOMO land, right? Where you were like, okay, maybe SpaceX is going to be able to deliver with Starship and be able to meet all those needs. Or maybe it's going to go take a lot longer and the engineering problems are going to be more complicated. And all of the people that you laid off across all of the NASA centers are going to be grumpy about this.
I think that what you're missing is that Starship is already on the critical path. Like for NASA to land on the moon this decade, Starship has to work. So if you've got a functional Artemis program, you have a functional Starship vehicle. Now, some people may say, well, Blue Origin's another human landing system contractor. And yes, they absolutely are. But they are not landing humans on the moon with this in this decade, and potentially not until the mid-2030s. We'll see. It's going to be a while. Like, the Starship is the only viable path to the moon in the 2020s in terms of a lunar lander at this point for NASA. So it's got to work. And I'm saying that, like, you don't need Starship to get Orion to the moon. You could do that. You know, this is what Jim Bridenstine talked about back in 2019 when he went for Congress and then got called on the carpet by Senator Richard Shelby. You know, he was talking about launching a Centaur upper stage on a at the time it was Delta IV Heavy, and then it was launching crew, and the rocket wasn't specified, but it could have been a Falcon Heavy launch that gets Orion into orbit, and then Orion docks with Centaur, goes to the moon, and it does the same mission as Artemis 3 and Artemis 2. And you know, if you add up the costs of a Vulcan, a Falcon Heavy, and some kind of docking mechanism, you know, what is that for the first launch? Maybe $1 billion, and then cost could come down quite a bit. So, I mean, it's we have the tools to replace the SLS right now. So I think that you're going to have some people in the White House who say, why don't we make this change? And there will be a deal struck with Congress whereby you find other things for Marshall Space Flight Center, Huntsville, Alabama, to do that they're losing out with getting rid of the SLS rocket.
And I think what you're suggesting isn't a very complicated switch if, with even a little more creativity, as you said, you bring in Falcon Heavy, maybe there's a way to adapt Crew Dragon to do lunar operations, a larger trunk. Who knows? You know, if you can invest in that pathway, then other
I don't think Orion goes away right away. I think Orion sticks around. I suspect that you would like to have Lockheed Martin's lobbying power not fighting against this. I think Boeing, you know, is a little bit less interested in its space program than it was a few years ago, and so you might get less resistance from Boeing than you would Lockheed, and so. Orion, let's face it, they've got to test the heat shield. But my understanding is that the modifications for Dragon to make that a lunar vehicle would be really significant. And quite frankly, I don't think SpaceX wants to, and Elon Musk in particular, wants to take the time to modify Dragon for lunar operations. And frankly, he views Dragon as a dead-end technology. We saw that last Friday when Gwen Shotwell was speaking at this Barron Capital event in New York City. She said, we expect to fly Falcon and Dragon for 6 to 8 more years. Now, think about that. That's incredible. The Falcon 9 is the best rocket in the world. No questions, right? In terms of reliability, you can launch 3 of them a week. The price, you know, the internal price for SpaceX is $20 million or less. It's the only, still the, after 9 years, it's still the only reusable rocket. And the president of the company is like, yeah, we don't need the best rocket in the world, you know, in 6 or 8 years. We're moving on.
Right.
So that's how
they view it with Crew Dragon.
That's especially how they view Crew Dragon. Crew Dragon as a dead end technology, even though it's the only operational U.S. human spaceflight vehicle. Now, SpaceX is like, we don't need it.
right, because we're going to go to Starship.
Yeah,
and I think there are big ifs about whether or not you want to put human beings into Starship and have them re-enter the Earth's atmosphere.
Oh, 100%.
Especially on the 50% higher velocity you're going to be looking at when they're coming back from the moon. Like, there's so much that would be much more complicated with Starship.
I agree. And I think, for all of the talk about humans to Mars and Starship and so forth, I think we're still quite a long ways away from putting humans on Starship. Now, it's going to happen sooner than I thought because, you know, let's face it, the regulatory environment for SpaceX is going to be more favorable.
Yes.
Very, very soon. And so they're going to go like gangbusters. And really, for the first time since I've been writing about SpaceX, you know, they are not capital constrained, right? If you look at what they're doing in South Texas in terms of building up the capacity to launch these rockets, they are putting in lots and lots of money. And they've never really been in a position before the last couple of years where they could just spend all the money that they needed to. Elon had always kept, you know, things very tightly. The budget were always very tight.
Is this due to funding from Starlink or is this due to funding from NASA?
It's not really due so much to funding from NASA. I mean, they paid them $2.9 billion over the lifetime of the HLS contract, which is nice, but that's not life-changing money. I think it's revenues from Starlink. You know, from 2015 to 2023, like they were investing very, they were developing two capital intensive projects, right? Like they're developing Starlink and Starship. And now Starlink is profitable. So like, I don't think they're going to be raking in the cash from Starlink for any time, but it's not going to be costing, like they're not going to have to put in $1 billion every year in development. So you can take those funds and put them into Starship. SpaceX has never had trouble going to the capital markets. They just did a private valuation last week. I think it was like a $255 billion company. So they can raise money at will. And so they see the goal line ahead of them and they're going for it.
So this sort of bleeds into the next topic that I wanted to talk about, and that is sort of the state of Starship. You know, we're recording this on Monday. The sixth flight of Starship is due to happen. It was supposed to happen before we talked, which would have been fun, but it's going to be happening tomorrow. They're going to do some more additional tests. But really, the question is, when do we see full reusability of the entire stack? When does Starship itself come in and get caught by the loving embrace of Mechazilla?
So I don't know. I would guess certainly not next year. You know, before the election, I was pretty concerned about the regulatory matter of, you know, Starship coming back to South Texas. It's going to be flying over Mexico, right? Northern Mexico on a trajectory to come back to be caught by a Mechazilla. And let's face it, that's like internationally, that's, you know, that would have been some really serious negotiations, I think, between the FAA, the State Department, and so forth. And I think now that will be much less of an issue because those people will be told to greenlight this. And so they will, you know, they will make that happen. I still think, though, you know, SpaceX, I don't think is going to refly this booster that they're flying tomorrow or the one that they caught last month. I think they're going to wait till the upgraded boosters come back and see how they are. And so I think you'll see first stage flying first. Honestly, I think that we're a ways away from seeing a second stage fly again. But I certainly wouldn't rule it out in 2026 to get full stack reusability. But the reality is you don't really need it. Because the first stage is where all the engines are, right? You know, that you're throwing away 36 engines if you lose the first stage and there's only six on the Starships. You know, we don't know the unit cost of building those, but you know, the engines are probably $3 or $4 million. The machine is probably, I mean, you could probably guess that they're building those for $15 or $20 million at most. And so, yeah, it sucks to lose them. But, you know, if you need to fly 10 of those for a lunar mission, you know, it's still like $200 million. And that's money. It's real money. But in the scope of what SpaceX is spending, those aren't going to break them, those costs.
So, like, using Starship to refuel the HLS, using not trying to go for reusability on the Starships, just making new ones and having them deliver the
tanker
fuel. I think
they're going for full reusability. Absolutely. Yeah. I just think they're going to have to go through quite a few of them before they actually get it all right and are comfortable enough in that hardware to fly it again. I could be totally wrong, but I think they'll maybe have like, I'd be surprised if it was for like flight 50 when they did full stack reusability.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, back to what we talked about at the beginning, that HLS is on the critical path for Artemis. And I think for a while there, it was, you know, Artemis was the part that was slowing things down, but it does look like the timeline of Artemis could easily slip due to HLS.
Absolutely. I mean, HLS has clearly been the reason why, you know, that it's, they're not going to make 2026. And it may not be till 2028 or later. But you got to remember, you know, the first SLS contracts were let in 2011 and it was a pretty straightforward rocket built from shuttle components. And the first HLS contracts from NASA were not let until the end of 2021. So, you know, the Starship, the lunar lander is the more complex piece of this. And, you know, SLS is, as I say, been funded by NASA for a decade longer. So, you know, yes, Starship is going to hold them up, but I mean, let's be real. The other components, Orion and Starship, or excuse me, SLS had a much bigger head start. But we're, you know, we'll see. Like the really big test, the really thing that I'm looking out for Fraser in 2025 is this one or more of these refueling tests in orbit, where you're going to see a Starship launch from one tower in South Texas, and then shortly after another one launches, and they dock in low Earth orbit, and then one of the vehicles transfers a lot of propellant to the other vehicles, and they enter the atmosphere. Now, from a physics standpoint, that should be fairly straightforward, right? But it's still really complex to dock two huge ships and then, you know, do this relatively delicate process of transferring propellant. And, you know, they'll probably do that more than once. And so, you know, if they get that done in the first quarter of 2025, then it's off to the races, but it could take, you know, quite a bit longer if they run into problems or challenges.
And demonstrating the test of transferring propellant is not the same as demonstrating that you can maintain your cryogenic propellants in space under those kind of conditions for long periods of time. Like, that's just running the clock forward to see if that worked.
No, that's just the next step. Then you've got to
right.
You know, have a Starship depot or whatever that is your kind of orbital Starship that's probably got more insulation on it. I don't know. I'm not an engineer, but sort of something to prevent boil off of your liquid oxygen and methane. And then, you know, then you've got to do a long duration test where you send a Starship out to the moon where it has to loiter for like, be able to loiter for like 270 days or something like that. For the Artemis guidelines or requirements. So yeah, they've got a ton of work ahead of them.
Yeah. You had a great article that came out a couple of weeks ago where you just laid out the to-do list that SpaceX has to be able to work through to fulfill their obligations to NASA, as well as start to meet some of their larger aspirations. And it's enormous. Like it went on and on and on. And you could see that there's just a lot riding on this. It feels like the progress is fast, and yet that's partly because the list of to-do items still stretches off into the distance.
I mean, that's frankly, you know, regardless of your politics, you know, that's why a Trump presidency is going to be a significant win for SpaceX, because almost certainly you're going to see an FAA, or if not an FAA, Department of Commerce, whatever ultimately ends up regulating launch licenses, be much more business friendly. And that, if you want to see SpaceX go fast, that really is like the number one thing that's now holding the company back. Because to accomplish all of these objectives, the thing you've got to do is fly Starship frequently, right? So you've got to go from once a month to once every, you know, every 2 weeks to once a week. I mean, probably by this time next year, they'll be launching Starships, you know, two or three a month, if not every week.
You know, a lot of people have been not critical, I guess, but they were sort of wondering when the whole Mars component, when do we get that city on Mars? Do you think that the reality of spaceflight has pushed that as the big audacious goal sort of into the, I don't know, like it's just considered less important these days?
Well, I think it's very important to Elon Musk, and then it's going to be therefore very important to the overall US spaceflight community, because, you know, SpaceX is so critical to all of those functions. But what my sense, and I don't know this for sure, this is just Eric Berger speculating, is that the official US government position will be, we're focusing on the moon with Artemis, but there will be a more supportive atmosphere for a human mission to Mars with NASA and SpaceX working together, right? So on one hand, SpaceX is going to be over here doing their Artemis government work. But on the other hand, they're going to be, you know, sort of building up some of the components and technologies for Mars. And I think once you see a couple of Starships land safely on Mars, I don't know if that's 2028, I don't know if that's 2030. But once you start to see some missions landing on Mars, then you'll start to see more NASA payloads going to Mars every 2 years. And that will build up some kind of reservoir for NASA and government support for Mars missions. But I think it's really still, SpaceX still has to go out and do it. You have to be able to do the propellant transfers. You have to do how many ever you know, Starship launches you need to support propellant for a Mars landing. I don't know if it's 10, 12, 16. We're not going to find that out until you see how efficient propellant transfer is, until you see how much boil-off concerns you have. But once SpaceX starts landing on Mars, then it becomes real. Think about back to 2020, right? Before the Demo 2 mission, there were still lots of people in the U.S. government who are kind of skeptical about SpaceX. This is kind of this company of jackasses. They really didn't prioritize safety, and can we really trust them? And then they put Bob and Doug in space on the space station. They bring them back safely. And that really changed, I think, the perception of Falcon 9, Dragon, and SpaceX to wait a minute, we can rely on these guys. And I think the same thing, there'll be that same similar sea change in opinion when you sort of get Starship landing on Mars. Who knows if they'll have cameras out videoing it? They probably will, though, because they're crazy. But then, you know, you sort of get down to Mars and you take video and, like, you see the surface of Mars from, like, 200 feet up. It's going to be super cool. I just think that those kind of imagery will really open a lot of eyes in the government to what is possible.
Right. All right, so I need to shift gears again. We got a schedule here. And so, you know, we saw Blue Origin finally roll out their first stage of New Glenn, taking on a big long drive through the streets to arrive at their pad. But we've already seen a delay from Blue Origin for launching the NASA Mars mission into 2025. So, you know, when do we think that we'll be able to see a first, even a hot fire of New Glenn, not to mention like an actual first test flight?
Hot fire, hopefully within weeks. The company is still pushing very, very hard to launch this year. That was the mandate when Jeff Bezos hired Dave Limp to be the new CEO of Blue Origin just a little more than a year ago. I mean, he told him, I want you to launch New Glenn in 2024. And so they have been pushing. The clock is ticking, right? It's November 18th today, and you have cutouts for the holidays in December, where you can't launch. So they're running out of time. You know, I think if they get out to the pad soon and do a hot fire before the end of the month, or even early December, they have potentially a pathway to launching this year. I think it's gonna be really close though.
Yeah. And then there are other companies that are, you know, sort of in the wings as well. So, I mean, but like United Launch Alliance is on the blocks. The Europeans are way behind with Ariane 6, which is still just in the same stage as Ariane, you know, a disposable rocket. So is the entire planet, except for maybe China, but is everyone just seeding the rocket market to SpaceX?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, let's be real. You'd be kind of a fool to want to compete against SpaceX unless you were a billionaire, right, who could underwrite. I mean, Jeff Bezos is putting about $2 billion into Blue Origin every year in an attempt to catch up to SpaceX. And Vulcan appears to be a fine rocket. And you know, they had the problem with the nozzle on their last test flight, and so I think they're going to get back to flight, and they'll probably launch maybe 8 to 10 times next year, which is great. And there's lots of demand for that vehicle, but you know, I don't think they're ever going to reuse BE-4 engines, despite talking about it. And the reality is they have been on the block for almost 2 years now. They've been up for sale. I first reported that. Others have reported that as well. Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin kicked the tires and decided the price was too high. Sierra Space kicked the tires more recently, decided the price was too high. It just wasn't worth it. And so, yeah, Lockheed Martin and Boeing want to get more money out of a sale. And Boeing, I think, is pretty clear about its interest in exiting parts of the space business. So ULA just isn't worth that much to buyers. That's just because I think its future is constrained, right? On one side, they're competing against SpaceX and they've lost, right? That's no question. The Falcon 9 handily defeated the Atlas and Delta rockets. And so they came up with Vulcan. But Vulcan is not as cheap as Falcon 9, and it's certainly not going to be cost competitive or payload competitive with Starship. And on the other side, you've got Blue Origin, right, which makes the engines you're using, bringing New Glenn to market. And New Glenn is a bigger, more powerful rocket. And quite frankly, Blue Origin can sell those at a loss. And we've seen that kind of business practice from Jeff Bezos before, so it would not shock me to see them pricing New Glenn lower than Vulcan. And so over time, you know, you're going to have two very large rockets subsidized by billionaires, essentially, that will push Vulcan to the side. I mean, Vulcan fills an important niche right now because the Department of Defense needs a second provider, and they are that provider. But you know, 5 or 10 years from now, the outlook for Vulcan is a little more dim, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, then there are a handful of smaller companies. We see tests. Of course, there's Rocket Lab, which is doing a great job setting up facility in the US, they're launching in New Zealand. So there are some interesting options. What about the Chinese? They, you know, I think people are a lot less familiar with what they're working on and what their schedules are, both on their science program, their human space exploration program, as well as their rocket system. What's your perspective on that?
So yeah, just before we get to the Chinese, just a few words about the US launch competitors. I think there's really three companies you have to watch in the United States beyond SpaceX, Blue Origin, ULA, and that would be Rocket Lab, which you mentioned. Have a lot of admiration for what Peter Beck has done. And he's pushing hard to get Neutron to the pad, and that is a nice vehicle, up to 16 tons. We'll see how many pains they go through in terms of landing it. I mean, if anyone who read Reentry should know how damned hard it is to build a medium lift rocket with a reusable first stage, it's very challenging. But they've got a great team, and I like their management. Firefly, you have to admire what they've done with against sort of in the one-ton rocket wars with Relativity Space and ABL. They have clearly emerged as the winner. And so Firefly is building a medium-lift rocket with Northrop, which I'm not sure there'll be a huge market for that, but we'll see. And then the other company is Stoke, right? They're building a fully reusable rocket called Nova. Great team, pretty great engineering, a different approach for second-stage reuse than SpaceX is doing. So I think they're going to be a lot of fun to watch. But beyond that, there's not too much to be excited about. So then you go over to China, and about 7 or 8 years ago, the government saw what NASA was doing with the commercial cargo and commercial crew program, and saw that's how that was generating this commercial space industry, and said, "We want some of that, right? That's like." That's the way to go. And so China has the most vibrant commercial space industry outside the United States. And what they did is they basically started licensing their government technology to private companies and investors. And so initially what you saw was those companies taking the government solid rockets and taking some of their liquid engines and trying, you know, building new launch systems with those. And then SpaceX started having success landing Falcon 9s and reusing Falcon 9s. And so you saw a whole big pivot. It's like almost every week you see like a new rendering from China of a rocket that looks exactly like the Falcon 9 or looks exactly now like Starship, right? They're essentially, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's true. They're copying what SpaceX is doing. And frankly, that's the smart thing to do, right? Like SpaceX has shown the pathway. So don't try to be creative and build like a system that doesn't look like Falcon 9 because you don't like Elon Musk or SpaceX or whatever. Like they're the winners, like copy what they're doing. And so you're seeing lots of companies with pretty good PowerPoints, but we're also starting to see some hardware, right? There have been some high altitude tests with some landing, some successful, some not, but that is where the most activity is. So I think like the first reusable rocket was the Falcon 9, the second was Starship, the third was New Glenn, and then we may have 3 or 4 Chinese rockets before we start to see Neutron landing. So there's lots of activity in China on the commercial side. And then also like the lunar program, like that is the competition. That is the race, right? NASA and Artemis are racing against China and the International Lunar Research Station. You know, some people say, well, it's not really a competition, but it's absolutely a competition. You know, you know this, like at the South Pole of the Moon, there's a limited amount of resource, real estate, where you have ready access to the permanently shadowed regions of lunar craters that you're interested in, right, where the ice is. But you can also generate consistent solar energy. So there's going to be competition. Whoever gets there first is going to get the prime real estate. So it's totally a competition.
And, you know, the plans for China, like normally they're quite secretive about what they're working on, and we don't really get a sense of what they did until after they did it. But their plans for lunar exploration have been right out there in plain sight, and they're following their milestones to a T. I mean, from the very first Taikonaut who launched to the building of their various space stations to their missions to the moon, their sample returns to the missions to the moon, their missions to Mars. And now they're planned sample return mission from Mars and then leading up to them sending humans. I mean, all the pieces are in place in this very cogent plan that also has this long-term strategy. When they say they're going to set humans on the moon around 2030, I believe them.
I think so. I think there's a couple of wild cards. First of all, they could have setbacks, right? They could have accidents like the Apollo 1 fire, or, you know, some kind of crew accidents. I mean, let's be honest, their lunar program has been phenomenally successful. Like, they've hit every one of their missions has been a success, and they've done some really technically challenging things with returning samples from the far side of the moon. So you have to give them credit, but they could definitely, you know, have setbacks, right? And then also, you know, the financial situation in China is not great, and the government's got a lot of irons in the fire with the housing, you know, market and just lots of other issues. And they could decide that their financial priorities are elsewhere in the next 5 to 7 years. But I agree with you. I think that by and large, they're on track to put humans on the South Pole of the moon by around 2030. Now, the key difference, and I do think this is important. Look, geopolitically, if China beats NASA back to the moon, and puts a couple of Taikonauts down on the South Pole first, that's a kind of a big deal. But the really important thing is like putting the infrastructure there. And so the initial Chinese lander is a lot like the lunar module. Big surprise, right? But it's basically like the lunar module. And I think my understanding is that the Taikonauts will be on the surface for several hours, right? Not very long. So it's kind of a touch and go mission. And so if you're NASA coming along with SpaceX and you're starting to churn Starships out there, and you know, Starship can bring hundred tons or more to lunar surface, you can really start to build up infrastructure quickly. So China may win like the race, but the NASA could ultimately win the competition, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a couple of questions from the audience. I let my patron community know that I was going to talk to you. Sean Patterson asks, are there any groups who are seriously looking at a Mars cycler in a practical way, or is everything still theoretical?
It's all theoretical. From time to time, you would hear NASA talk about the Lunar Gateway as a testbed for the technologies of a ship that could, you know, go to Mars. Like the idea is that you'd have some modules on Gateway and in the deep space environment for 10 or 15 years, you could get some really good sense of what life support technologies would work in that environment. But I think that was just lip service. I still think like the chance that we ever see a lunar gateway fly in any kind of semblance is like less than 50%.
Even though the hardware is being built, I mean, the hardware has begun construction.
They've been building that hardware for years, man.
Okay, all right.
And we're still years away from launch. And if you're the incoming administration, you look at the Lunar Gateway and you say, does this help me get to the surface of the moon? No, it makes it more difficult. Okay. Does this help me get to Mars? No, because it's not an optimal place for a refueling station. Actually, for refueling missions to Mars, right? The place to do that's not the moon, it's low Earth orbit. So I mean, it's not really advancing your goals. It's being perfectly honest, the Lunar Gateway exists for two reasons. Number one, SLS and Orion could not get to the lunar surface, didn't have the delta V. Orion couldn't get to low lunar orbits. They had to put something in a higher orbit around the moon and RHO. And the other reason is Johnson Space Center, a few miles down the road from me, wanted to keep a space station going after the International Space Station. So that's the Lunar Gateway. And it's been that was the original reason really it was created. And so I think anyway, I don't think Lunar Gateway will happen. And even if it does, I don't think it's a great testbed for a Mars cycler. So at this point, it's Starship or bust, because NASA is not working on any hardware at all that could be credibly described as a spaceship that could take humans from Earth to Mars and back.
But that's, we're back into the, you're just sort of putting all your eggs in the SpaceX basket, which we'll see how it all plays out.
I mean, that is, but Fraser, that is the only deep space, that is the only company building deep space hardware. There's no government building.
Yeah.
It.
No, I don't
There's
like
no
the decision.
NASA funding for a Mars spaceship. NASA doesn't have the funding to build lunar rovers at this point. I mean, there's no funding for it. So
yeah. While SpaceX is obsessed to an almost cultish level with sending humans to Mars.
Think about it this way.
Right.
Like I fundamentally absolutely agree that putting all your eggs in the SpaceX basket is not something you want to do. Right. Like you don't want them to have the majority of the contracts, but let's think about the Orion spacecraft, right? Pretty simple vehicle. It's a capsule. Four people inside of it for up to 21 days, goes to the moon and back. It's only got limited capacity. So the astronauts are coming back are bringing like 50 kilograms of rocks. That's all they can fit inside Orion. And we started development of Orion in 2005. So it's been 20 years. So do you think a human spacecraft that can go to Mars and back is more complicated than Orion? Of course. It's much bigger. Much more expensive. So if you were to let contracts tomorrow, Fraser Crane, congratulations. You're the next administrator of NASA. And you're like, we're going to build a Mars spacecraft. I mean, it's going to take at least 20 years, right? So that gets us to 20. So if you want to do this in our lifetimes, there's one vehicle that's going to be able to do it. So if you don't like Starship and you like SpaceX, then that's fine. You're just not going to Mars in our lifetimes.
Right.
I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah. I mean, you are looking at how many administrations, three administrations probably, they're going to have to be willing to keep their eyes directed at Mars one after the other and, you know, hand over the baton one after the other with the same level of enthusiasm. And we know that it didn't happen. We saw the target go, we're going to go to the moon. No, we're going to go to Mars. No, we're going to go to an asteroid. No, we're going back to the moon. Are we though? You know, that's the sort of the journey that goal takes. And yet you then talk to SpaceX people and they just say, and we're going to be living on Mars and we're all going to go to Mars and Mars, Mars, Mars. And so it's really hard to.
So I don't think fundamentally NASA has ever been serious about sending humans to Mars. Like it's just, even during the Journey to Mars years with Charlie Bolden in the mid 2010s, it never was real. Like no one was ever working on any hardware. And that's like, if the government were to do that, that's a half a trillion dollar program at least. And just no one is going to fund that, right? There's no impetus for the government to do it. And so for humans to actually go to Mars, and look, there are so many challenges, right? I read A City on Mars by the Wienersmith, right? It's a great book. There's so many challenges to overcome, and the transportation piece is just really the first significant challenge, but it's the most important one, because if you don't solve that, then you don't do any of the rest of them. You need a forcing function. And so if you all of a sudden have a transportation vehicle that's theoretically capable of this, then you can start to talk realistically about a Mars mission. Otherwise, you're just writing technical papers and architectures that are going to sit around in drawers, and in 30 years, people look back at them, you know, for research purposes. I don't know. We're not going to Mars absent a forcing function. The only forcing function right now is the availability of Starship.
Right. And maybe the aspirations of the Chinese.
Maybe. I mean, maybe. Yeah, that would be a forcing function. But again, like, if you look out at their program through 2050, I don't think they had humans to Mars on their roadmap, did they?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When did they say it? When were they?
Late 2030s. Their recent plan was, you know, humans on the moon 2030, starting to build the infrastructure, and then starting to, you know, use the successes gained from the Mars sample as a way to lead to humans to Mars. So I think, I mean, I don't think we would see even Chinese boots on the ground in until the 2040s.
Yes, right, right, yeah. Because, so, I mean, they're talking about like using the Long March 9 rocket, which now looks like a Starship copycat, to build up the lunar colony settlement in the 2030s. And so the idea that we'd then turn that around and go to Mars very quickly, it just...
Or even launch from Mars. Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, I think you're exactly right. But I think the...
But you're right. China is the other potential forcing function. That just, that theory, I think, just has some problems with it.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, Zach and Kelly with their book, they really nailed it, which is that there is, no one has come up with a reasonable argument on why anybody should go to Mars beyond a couple of boots on the ground to explore the place and come home and say, we did it. You know, humanity is the best. But to actually like go there because we need to get our eggs out of it, you know, into another basket, that argument doesn't hold. That there's money to be made, that argument doesn't hold. Like, there's a ton of reasons. Like, there's no good reason to do it.
There's one good
apart
reason.
From it's awesome.
No, no, there's one good reason.
Yeah.
And where I disagree with him, I think the one good reason to go is to literally make human a spacefaring species. Like, if we are going to live on other worlds, we have to start somewhere. And Mars, as inhospitable as it is, and it's very, very, very deadly world, that is the best place to start. So I think you got to start somewhere with space settlement, and Mars is the place to start. And so that is the only good reason. Like,
yeah, no, I think an even more kind of boiled down version of that is because it's awesome. And I think, you know, I talked to them and interviewed them as well. And I think that was the gist, is like, just that, you know, back to Kennedy, we go to space not because it's easy, we do it because it's hard. Why do you climb a mountain? You climb a mountain because it's there. Why do we go to space? Because that's what's next. And if you're going to try to shroud your reasons for going in any other thing, then when those clearly aren't going to carry the day, then you're left without a really good rationale for being able to do this thing. But if we can all agree that the reason we want to go to space is because we all want to go to space, then it's really hard to talk us out of going to space because we still want to go to space.
I absolutely agree. And I would say that, like, if you were going to Mars because it's awesome, you would do a Flags and Footprints mission, right? You would go and come back.
Or if you have more scientific questions, like, again, but, you know, you're not going because...
Well, if you're a scientist, you're probably like, I don't want humans on Mars messing up my pristine laboratory.
Possibly, yeah.
But yeah. I think there is... I think the settlement issue is the important issue, and no government is going to do that, right? Like, across decades of history, no government has paid for settlement in space, and probably will. The question, the real challenge, and you hit on this with Mars, is if you look back at historical analogs, like why did we settle North America, right? It was economics, right? First, they were looking for a trade route to India. And then, you know, you had people coming, you signed up the Virginia Company for tobacco and other trading purposes. Then you had escaping religious persecution in New England. Like, none of those analogs hold for Mars, right? We're not going there for economic gain. I can't think of any resource you would produce on Mars and bring back to Earth. Is there any? I don't think there is, right? No. So we're not going there for economic purposes, even though there probably would come some over time. So the only reason to go is like literally to establish human settlements there.
Yeah. Yeah. In the same way that we live in Antarctica, that we have people in Antarctica. Yep. Like, yep. We're not there because it's economically viable. We're there because it's a science station and because it's important to check out every single part of planet Earth. And while we can, we do. So Eric, what are you obsessed with right now?
Oh, man. One of the things I'm really interested in is commercial space stations. These are the follow-ons to the International Space Station. I've been spending a lot of time understanding the companies that are involved in this. And it's just, it's part of this whole trend of NASA has gone from building spaceships and rockets to buying services. And there are going to be some hits and misses along the way in that journey. And so I'm just really trying to understand where we are sort of at this stage of commercial space and what NASA can do to be successful with these programs going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, we're seeing difficulty in even those companies there was hoping to be commercial companies and to be able to provide this, these services at the same time that NASA is getting out of the space station business. And so you're not seeing a really obvious successor. I mean, Sierra Space has got some really exciting stuff with their inflatables. You're seeing other companies, but we don't, I don't know who will carry the torch.
That's the fun. Yeah. I look at all the prospective space station operators and they all have strengths and weaknesses. And none of them are clear to me that that is going to be the company that, that sort of steps up and puts up a station that replaces the ISS.
But ISS is coming down. And so, there will be a day 6 years from now when only the Chinese have a space station. I mean, that could be the reality.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Eric, thank you so much. Enjoy the flight tomorrow. I guess when people see this, it will have already happened or delayed. And good luck navigating these next 4 years.
You too, Fraser. Thanks so much for the time.
All right. All right. Take care. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Eric Berger. Now, I passed along a question from the Patreon community about the state of space journalism. And we then had a fairly lengthy conversation about sort of how good space journalism is. How are people dealing with the behavior of Elon Musk and sort of what does the future look like for space journalism? And so we're going to have that available completely for free over on our Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/universetoday and follow us there. It's totally free. And then you can watch all of that additional content. Now I want to give you some of my thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew Gross, Barry Lake Roofing, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, ScienceWorldRecord.org, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. Hopefully at the time that you are watching this, we will know what happened with the sixth flight of Starship. Now, I've been able to get together with Scott Manley and Marcus House and do an analysis of each of the former rocket launches. I don't know if we're going to do the sixth one. We'll find out. But if you want to kind of go back and really see the progress of SpaceX as they develop their Starship through each one of those iterations, definitely go and check out those videos. All right, we'll see you next time.